You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. And we are beginning a new book as we make our return to the printed page with Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club. We will be covering chapters 1 to 32 this week. Herds, you are challenged to solve this here murder mystery book.
Yay, I'm feeling pretty confident about this one.
By television host and presenter Richard Osmond, this is about a group of retirees at Cooper's Chase, a retirement home. Britain's first luxury retirement village, but actually
yeah,
the seventh.
I was going to say, some quick research reveals that that is a lie, much like many of the advertisements about the retirement home in this book.
Now, I will oversimplify things at the start here and say this is about a club of murder mystery enthusiasts who have a murder happen within their own presence.
Imagine if the Scooby-Doo gang grew old together and also became much more insane and also senile. You know,
Scooby-Doo? They're well past sane.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They become a very special sort of insanity and competent. It's great.
So the Thursday Murder Club is a group of four retirees, Joyce, Elizabeth, Ron, Ibrahim, and formerly Penny, who is now in hospital.
Yeah, Joyce has sort of replaced Penny on the squad, as it were. Yeah, we got Joyce, the quiet one, Elizabeth, the loud one, Ron, the buff one, apparently, and Ibrahim, who is the smart one, I think.
And then, essentially, after the death of Tony Curran, one of the two people involved in the construction and maintenance of Cooper's Chase, the facility formerly on the grounds of a nunnery, things start to go a bit haywire. A police investigation begins. Ron's son Jason becomes embroiled after a photo of him is found at the scene of the crime. Police Constable Donna DeFreitas is dragged onto the case.
Donna DeFreitas, best character.
After her boss is hoodwinked by the Thursday Murder Club.
Let's be clear. We just finished the chapter where Chris, her police boss, has been hoodwinked, and they do it in the most charming way possible. They sit him down, they give him tea and cake, but they completely soak the cake in vodka, and they make it so that he's like sitting on a tiny couch with people on either side of him. He's like balancing the teacup and bouncing. And there's a note that says he's with these lovely old people and he has to be very kind and respectful towards them because they're being respectful towards him. But he's sweating bullets like he's trying to interrogate a hardened killer. That's how he feels. That's how these old people feel.
It is amazing. Richard Osman lends so much of the page in that scene to talking about everything that the Thursday Murder Club has done on purpose to make him uncomfortable. And he keeps thinking to himself, oh goodness, I couldn't do that. It would seem rude. They've been so nice.
The line is, they couldn't make this more uncomfortable for me if they tried.
Oh, and Chris, they tried.
They are trying. That's exactly what's going on. It's beautiful. And really, I feel like that's the first impression I got of this book as I sat down to read it. I am enjoying the heck out of this book. It is so much fun and so full of this like dry sarcasm. It's also very sad. There's lots of really sad moments. Yeah. But the impression you get from the start as you go on is that it's just a really, really good time. It's cozy.
The pace of the humor in this book is really quite unlike anything I've seen in a satirical murder mystery. You know, one of the ones that we've done on the show, The Three Taps, right back at the beginning, had a beautiful satirical introduction about an insurance company.
Yeah, it was very front-loaded, right?
But this book is constant in its satire in a way that is so well integrated. I feel like sometimes when you read intentionally humorous texts, it gets a bit exhausting. Like, by the time the next joke comes around, you're worn out. Yeah. But Richard Osman has done a fantastic job of drip feeding you the humor and using the time between each joke to build up to the joke without making it feel like the setup for a punchline.
I think the key to this really is that the humor comes from the characters and it makes you thoroughly endeared to them, right?
Yes.
It's not just jokes about the setting of the real world in Britain, of this retirement home even. It's about the home. It's about the characters that live within it. It's about their desperation and their movements towards like making something of themselves, even when the world has kind of pushed them aside. And before that can fully happen, they get taken to the willows when they get to, they lose their minds, they lose their memories. And all of this is kind of part of the narrative, all the dry humor and all this, like, you know, we're not going to let anybody in the world push us around. We're a bunch of old folks. And additionally, the regular chapters where we kind of switch perspective to perspective, are broken up as well by the Joyce chapters, which are specifically from the perspective of the quiet one, Joyce, whose sort of superpower is that she's so like quiet and careful in the way that she moves around the retirement village that she can get stuff done without people even realizing that she's fixed their problems.
There's a very interesting line when we're first introduced to Joyce where she says, oh no, I'm not the interesting one in my family. That would be my daughter. She runs a hedge fund.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And it's delivered in the most beautifully dry way. But my impression of that is kind of meant to be setting up that like she's used to being a chameleon and she's passed it down to her daughter.
I mean, there's a quote in there. I think she's from Elizabeth talking about how she's lied to the cops. She's trying to get into the police station. She's saying, you know, my handbag's been stolen. And Joyce thinks to herself, oh, so that's why she didn't have a handbag on her. So she could lie about this. And, you know, she makes a quip to the female police officer, that being Donna, saying, you know, I'm a chameleon. Sometimes I have to be a nun to get into a police station and speak with you privately. Sometimes that just has to happen, dear. She's lovely. Elizabeth, she's not my favorite character, but I think she's second.
Yeah, it's, I don't want to go picking favorites here.
I have to pick favorites. I have to.
You walk into an old folks home and you pick favorites, Ben?
Yes, although it's not one of the old folks, or at least it's not one of the pensioners. You know, residing within the grounds. I just want to be very clear on this. My favorite character, and this is going to feed into the mystery discussion, but I need to get this out there. My favorite character is Ian Ventham. He is the most despicable, evil, hammy, rich, awful human being. Like, he wants to pursue a project called The Woodlands, which involves cutting down the woods. Like, he spins everything and he thinks he's very clever, and he has a painting of himself holding a sword in his lounge room.
Yeah.
And in most murder mysteries, I would say he'd be the one to get it.
The entire book until the actual murder happens is setting up that Ian is going to be the one to die, and he's prepared for it and all of the things he's done to avoid it.
Yep.
And then the person he was expecting to kill him just gets knocked off with absolutely
no fanfare. It's great.
Yeah. I think explicitly the thing that makes the pacing of the humor work, as I was mentioning earlier, is that as that setup feeling that I was talking about is built by that contrast between the in principle kind of grim situation of waiting for death effectively, and then contrasted by how lively all of these characters are. There is an incredible sense of youth about them right from the beginning, when we have a scene with the police constable Donna De Freitas coming to give a security talk, and they just completely disarm her, being like, we've had the whole security talk, can we talk about something else?
We talk about blood and murders, let's go. And that's why the Thursday Mystery Club exists.
Exactly.
They're out there fun. Or the Japanese orchestral discussion, which is how they disguise it on the time. They're like, we'd like to book the puzzle room for our Japanese opera discussion. And it is definitely not that.
So that they're never bothered.
Exactly.
It's really interesting in contrast to Masako Togawa's The Master Key, which we covered earlier this year, because both of them very much play on those same feelings of being left behind by society. Whereas The Master Key was much more about how being left behind can crush you as an individual. This story is much more about people absolutely just taking it for themselves, you know, taking that sense of freedom by not having any expectations left of you other than that you will die and being left to run amok and enjoy yourself.
I was going to make a similar point, but I feel like you put it so beautifully. I don't think I can top that, but you're absolutely right. Like the narrative, like hook of this novel is that we're dealing with characters who completely own the fact that they have nothing left and that they can get away with a lot more than most people could. They're more savvy, and they're constantly underestimated by the younger people around them. There are very few characters. Donna is one of them, because she's used to coming to the old folks' home and chatting with them about cybersecurity and, you know, the Nigerians.
If we can even use that word anymore.
If we can even use that word anymore. It's offensive.
It's
I think.
A good line.
That's terrible. But yeah, like Donna is savvy to their ways, and yet she sits by as she watches her boss Chris get totally rolled over by these characters. Yeah. And that consistently happens. And I hope that the littlest old person of them all will perhaps triumph in the end.
But I suppose since we're getting into the technicalities, we'll take a pause there and come back to talk a bit more about this.
We'll have to talk about Ian's smoothie mix another time.
I know. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing chapters 1 to 32 of Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club here on Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. And we'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here with you, and I am joined on the line by R.W.R. McDonald, author of The Nancys and Nancy Business, a couple of very well-received crime and mystery novels about two gay uncles and their niece, Tippi Chan, who go about as a Nancy Drew fan club solving murders in a small Kiwi town with no regard for the proper procedure. And Rob, I thought you would be the perfect person to come on and talk while we're covering Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club, because they're complete flip sides, you know, old people and the expectations we have of them as opposed to kids and the queers and what we expect of them. You know, why put these characters up in this situation where they're just so, I guess, out of what we would normally expect from crime fiction?
Firstly, thank you very much for having me on the show. I love these unlikely heroes. I think part of the fun of amateur detectives is, you know, for the reader at home, you know, they can put themselves in that situation. But also I think with a child, and, you know, we see with kids all the time they're always getting told off because they're always breaking rules, right? So to have them fearlessly investigating because they don't know any better. And also with children, you know, they get overlooked. There'll be adults talking who kind of forget the kids there or, you know, don't really pay them too much attention or undermine their intelligence. And I like the pairing with, I'm a gay dad, so I've got two daughters. And it's something that you don't really see that much of in many stories is, you know, the gay man with a girl, with a child, sort of that dynamic, which is sort of like here we've got an uncle and his niece and also his boyfriend and the relationship that the boyfriend has with Tippi, which is almost, I mean, they call it a, you know, it's like their sisters. So there was that dynamic. But I love the idea, and I haven't read Richard Osman's book yet, but this idea that you're not constricted with procedures or policy, like, you know, like the police would be or journalists.
And the other thing that I thought was really fun challenging up front on the page is at the book launch you mentioned that you had kind of written what you felt was a post-homophobic world, which you can definitely see because the book's just queer as heck. And yeah. I love it. But the other thing that's really interesting is even though it's a post-homophobic world, it doesn't shy away from dealing with stereotypes, with the prejudices that we still have. For example, there's a comment where Devin says that he's going to, you know, bring Tippi's eyes out. And she's like, is he doing an Asian thing? Is he... And, you know, like we still see that that's a part of the world. Why is it important to just challenge those issues so directly when historically crime fiction, especially like crime fiction, has a long history of being very progressive for its time, but not so much with the queers?
Yeah, with the Nancys, I wanted to make it a post-homophobic world. So homophobia had existed, everyone moved on, but what you've got is this legacy, and it's a legacy, you know, all of us gay people carry, which is, you know, when we were growing up, because the culture at the time, and I'm talking like in New Zealand or Australia or the Western world, was so opposed to our very beings that the world has moved on, but there's still stuff that we're processing. We're still feeling on the outside. I mean, when we had the plebiscite, you know, things really came to the surface, and it was sort of, yeah, to have everyone vote on your rights was, you know, insane, really. Yeah. So with the Nancys, I thought, okay, I don't want to write a story where, you know, my main characters are going to get homophobic taunts or beaten up or anything. Let's just remove that and see what happens when you do that. But, of course, removing that, we still have everything else. So we still have racism. We still have misogyny. We still have all the other problems of the world. And so it was interesting to, I guess, maybe that then they get amplified more in the absence with these queer characters, or you know, I mean, Tippy's a mixed race character, and, you know, I'm super, super aware about checking in with my friends and readers who are, you know, of her experience. And so that's something which, as the series will progress, Tippy, you know, she's just starting to, and Nancy Business really start to get on her radar. She's got her fantastic Nai Nai, who's lives in Shanghai, who's really pushing the cultural thing. So it's not something that I think we should shy away from at all. It's just another layer. And the thing with the Nancys and Nancy Business is this is these characters' life. So I think that's the thing. I try to take that as seriously as I can. Even if they're doing crazy things, this is still their life.
Yeah, I think, you know, with this and the Thursday Murder Club, the core element that we've touched on is that it's about underestimating people in any way, shape, or form. And I really like that, you know, so many of the thematics come back to that in both novels, because the fact is that were these people outside the pages of a book, they'd have a full life experience. They'd have a life just as real as your own. And, you know, fleshing that out in so much detail with, you know, not pulling punches, essentially, I think is really important and lends so much authenticity to actions that are really just kind of ridiculous.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I was speaking with Andrew on Final Draft. Yeah, and we were talking around this that aspect of the characters and how they have their own reality and how important that is. And I think the other thing is also, as we know, you know, we could be ourselves solving a mystery, but that doesn't mean we don't have the family dramas. We don't have everything else going on at the same time. And I don't know about you and your listeners, but for me, usually when there's something important is when everything seems to pile on from all directions.
I'll just pretend I don't have 1,000 unread emails on my other screen to my side here.
Exactly. So I wanted to sort of represent that. It's just like, yeah, I mean, imagine if they could solve a mystery in a vacuum, but that's just not not the world that I know.
It's such a beautiful contrast to the traditional mystery idea of a completely closed off, isolated mansion where it just tries to deny that anything else is going on in the world, because the only thing that matters here in the mystery, and don't get me wrong, as a classic mystery fan, I love that, but there's a whole other level of specialty and wonder to just sticking something in the real world and having to deal with the consequences.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, speaking of classic mystery, I've heard whisperings, by which I mean you've said out loud at several public events, that you were kind of had your ear towards a more traditional murder mystery. What is your ideal setting for the classic whodunit? What twist does Rob McDonald put on that? Or is that still kind of sitting away at the back of the brain?
Is this for the next project? So it is, you're right, I did say it publicly. So it's a take on the traditional manor house murder mystery. You know, you've got the countess and you've got your house staff and all of that. And it's an interesting time as well, because it's the Depression. A lot of the country homes are falling into ruin. So it's kind of subverting that. There's a Miss Marple type character who is actually pretty vile and has a copy of Mein Kampf at her bedside table. Yeah. So, yes, it will have a bit of flavor to it.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking just a couple of weeks ago on the show, we were speaking with John Ingold, who very much had a character lean in the same direction. And
nice.
You know, I love challenging those ideas, because we must be rid of them.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely.
Anyhow, Rob, it has been such a gem talking to you about Nancy Business and getting the chance to read it. If you want to get yourself a copy of the book, we'll have links up on the podcast, and I can thoroughly recommend it, having gone through both books in the series myself. Thank you for joining us.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
We are discussing Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club, and we'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here discussing Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club, chapters 1 to 32. And welcome to the part of the show where we like to discuss the murder and the mystery, all of its technicalities, make a big messy web of it all. And Herds, before we begin today, we had a deliberation after having Sean Britton on the show and going through interactive fiction, where we realized that this show, Herds, needs a little bit more spice in its soup.
I agree. A bit more beet in the smoothie, as it were.
Yes. So, what we are going to do from now on, Herds, is when we pose theories each episode of the show, instead of sticking with the theory 2 weeks in a row, because, you know, sometimes we're just correct and we have to spin around in circles talking about the same points. Instead, Herds, one of the 3 points in our triple or nothing game this year is for posing 2 distinct theories. It doesn't matter whether one of those theories is correct. As long as you can pose 2 arguably competent theories 1 week after the other, you can have one of those 3 points.
The main thing is that you don't just say, I thought it was Father Mackey. And you're like, but why and how? And I say, I don't know. He's a church guy. It's just got to be fleshed out and like reasonable and more or less plausible.
And I think this will harken back to the good old days of fishing poles on ladders and...
What a good theory.
Guns on the strings, machines in walls. I think
crossbow bolts in walls, yeah.
You know what? I do wonder, Herds, should we add or remove the stipulation that the theories must follow the rules? Because quite frankly, I think we should remove the stipulation.
Throw it out. Rules don't matter. The rules are made to be broken.
It doesn't have to be fair play. So if you want to suggest to me that Ian Ventham threw a spanner from 10 kilometers away and it just happened to land on the back of Tony Curran's head today.
I mean, it does say that the spanner flew through the air. I mean, I assume that's because somebody hit him really hard, but maybe it was a catapult. Anyway, that's not my theory. Although Ian does have enough money to probably rent a catapult. And
as I said,
trebuchet.
He sounds like a Street Fighter villain, and that does seem like something a Street Fighter villain would do.
You would set up the trebuchet on the hill that he wants to buy.
Oh, you're
and
so
then
right.
Put the lantern underneath the rope, the fire, and so it burns through the rope, and he knows it'll take exactly 20 minutes. So he'll be
That's
his alibi when the trebuchet goes off, and he wants to buy the hill so he can cover it up.
And that's why they were talking about painting construction equipment black, because they needed to hide the trebuchet.
That's it. That's right. I forgot about that detail, but yeah, that's exactly it. It's not for the bulldozer or whatever. It's for the trebuchet. The trebuchet needs to be black. Now that is not the theory I want to pose to you today, because I feel like I'm almost disappointed. I know, but I mean, that could be a third theory that I come back to next week.
Listen, if you completely botch everything else in this novel, maybe you can still walk away with an extra point for that alone.
I'd be okay with it. Look, if we're getting points for entertaining theories, I'm in my element.
Yeah, that's screwed.
That is entirely what I am here for. Okay, let's get into what I think is the actual theory here, because I went through a lot of thoughts as I was reading this novel. I thought, first off, we have Ian Ventham, who is the crazy megalomaniacal businessman. He's not the killer. It's impossible. He has an alibi for one thing. I didn't even think of that until you pointed that to me shortly before we started airing. Honestly, I didn't even think about that. But he's not a killer. No way. He's also like, oh yeah, that guy's Tony's. Is it Tony? Yeah, Tony's totally not going to kill me. It's not going to happen. So it's not Ian. That's for sure. There's Father Mackey. He seems pretty like frail and panicky. I don't think it's Father Mackey.
It's far
Mackey.
Too passive.
There's the club in general. The Thursday Murder Club. Wouldn't it be fun if it was one of them? But also they're all old people and they're far too lovable. Again, same problem as Father Mackey.
I mean, that would be having the detective do it, and that would break the rules.
I mean, are they all the detective though?
Well, that also breaks another
some
rule.
Some of them
so
are very quiet.
We're screwed either way.
But there is a character who has been involved in money. And is actually the only character who knew that Tony was going to kill Ian in the first place. And that is Bogdan Jankowski. That's a great last name. He is a pool tiler, apparently. I don't know what his broad title
is. He is an underpaid construction worker.
Yeah. Tony Curran's underpaid successor. Yeah, because in the very, like, near the very opening of the novel, we get a scene where Ian goes to Bogdan and he says, you know, I feel like I need to go fire Tony real quick. Boy, I hope he doesn't kill me. You're going to replace him. And so the easy solution here of like the why, I feel like the how is pretty self-explanatory. Bogdan walks up behind him and bops him with a wrench. But the why here very simply is just that if Bogdan knows, because Tony's like a gang guy, or he was, he knows that Tony's got the murder blood in him, he'll go to Tony's house and kill him so that he won't lose his job. I don't know. What do you think? Like, that's kind of where my head's at. Do you have a counterpoint? Do you think there's a more reasonable culprit?
Oof, goodness hurts.
Like, obviously, in my head, I feel pretty confident on the Who. I also did a bit of thinking about accomplices, but in the internal, like, monologues of a lot of the characters, like, the father is like, oh, he's a Catholic, so he's probably not familiar with Bogdan. And also, why would Bogdan leave pictures of his accomplices at the bar photo? How would he leave that at the scene of the crime? I had a thought at one point that maybe somebody else had left the photo there, somebody who stumbled on the scene later, similar to previous novels that are similar to this one. sort of similar. People guiding the investigation behind the scenes. But no, I think that Bogdan left the photo there to implicate the boxer and the other characters that are in the photo.
Well, here's a pitch for you, Herds.
What's the pitch?
We find out in the last few chapters that we've covered today that Chris Hudson, the investigator in charge of this all, is a big fan of Jason Ritchie as a boxer. He knows his catchphrases. He knows his poses. He does them in time with Jason when he arrives. They have
the
a
cop.
Big congratulatory speech. Do you not think, Herds, that Jason's sticking around here trying to cover his backside with someone he knows he can manipulate because they're a fan?
Maybe. I guess that's possible. Like, the problem is, like, what reasoning would Jason have? Like, if he wanted to, like, what reasoning would Jason have to actually go and use his boxing hands on Tony? Because if he wants to stop the cemetery removal and the Woodland project, it'd be much smarter to go after Ian. That's the thing. That's why I feel like the switch that's occurred, where it's not the evil guy that's getting murdered, it's his underling who wanted to kill him, like, that's important. So I want to dissect the motive there. And I don't know what motive that young blood boxer man has for killing him, because it's not for money.
Well,
he's already pretty well off.
Let's be clear. He's not a young blood boxer. He's a lot younger than the rest of the characters in the story.
He's still 46, I think.
I think it's more likely that, given the photo, we're meant to find out that Jason Ritchie is still embroiled with Tony Curran, who, as we know, was a drug dealer back in the day.
It's true.
We know that Jason still has a good bond with his father, who is living in the apartment complex. We know that things are going to be tumultuous for the apartment complex when things all start to get ripped off. And we know that Ron Ritchie was a strong unionist and anti-capitalist.
True, we do.
So Jason's been raised in that environment. I agree.
But why would he go after Tony? No, Ian, we learned a couple chapters ago. I can tell this is a fake theory because we learned a couple chapters ago.
You're saying I'm not just telling you the correct answer?
No, that's not
That's
true.
Crazy.
That's impossible. It's impossible. Look, nobody has tried that on this show. We've tried it on another show, but not on this show.
Not this show.
Not this one. So, look, the problem is that, A, Ron is a good guy, and I feel like that would rub off on his son, more or less. Even if he's been involved in this drug stuff, I don't think he would go, like, he might go as far as murder, but he would have to kill again. He would have to kill Ian or Bogdan. Like, if he's killed
the first, like... And what if that happens? Like,
well, then I'll revisit it when we get there. If that's how that goes, I'll revisit it. But in order to shut down the production, really, he should have gone after Ian.
The other thing I have to ask you, Herds, is the Thursday Murder Club. What do you think they possibly will have to do in actually wrapping up this investigation? How can they solve the case of Bogdan killing Tony Curran?
Like, I will say, just so it's on record, like, the obvious connection, if I have to pick someone, because we have four characters who can talk in the Thursday Murder Club and one who can't, is it something to do with Penny and, like, one of her old cases? But that's the best I could give you in terms of, like, what is the personal connection?
Well, Herds, I hope for your sake, Bogdan is in fact the killer.
Me too.
Because you will have to pose a theory next week, and it's going to be quite an interesting one.
If I suddenly realize it was horribly wrong, I guess I'll have to figure out how to pose a correct theory that is also entertaining, which is a good fun time for all.
We are going to be going next week up to chapter 61 of The Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman. I hope you're prepared, Herds. Things happened that I don't think you will be expecting, and I am so excited.
I'm excited for hopefully more murder. That sounds like fun to me. And for Ian to live a long and healthy life.
A long and healthy life.
He's so dead.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds here on your Murder Mystery World Tour. We'll be back next week with more of The Thursday Murder Club. See you then.